Here is how school works. There's a whole range of skills that kids are supposed to learn from one grade level to the next. Every classroom has a teacher who knows the stuff the kids need to learn. That teacher makes sure the kids are learning. Whether by giving tests or assigning book reports, you know the drill. Some people really question that model, and one of the movements that's grown up in reaction to it is unschooling. It's a specific type of homeschooling that's all about following the child's natural curiosity. Does this sound amazing? Ridiculous? Maybe both? Well, unschooling's been around long enough that we can get some stories and some data on how it actually works. I'm Gina Kaufman today on KCUR Central Standard, Unschooling. Let's start with a local parent who's done it. Jessica Mattingly, good morning.
Good morning.
How old are your kids?
I have six children. I have one that is 25, one that is 19, a daughter that is 17, a son that is 14, a daughter that is 11, and a daughter that is 4, our straggler.
Tell me the story behind your decision to take what I think it's fair to call a less conventional approach to education. When did you first start thinking about it?
Well, I had always hope to unschool my own children. I had actually grown up with cousins who were my age that were homeschooled, which was really unusual in the 80s. And as a child, I just watched what they were doing and thought their life looked like more fun than mine. And so if I had the opportunity to do that for my own kids, that's what I wanted to do.
Can you describe that a little bit more, though? Sure. Like how your experience compared to theirs and what you were noticing as a child about that difference, other than they get to stay home?
Right. And unbeknownst to me, they were some of the original unschoolers that came out of like the John Holt movement of the 70s and 80s. But they just had a lot more freedom to explore. They did a lot of like family trips in the off season. They spent several months on a sailboat. They spent several months doing RV trips around the country. And they really just got to pursue those things that invigorated them and really brought them joy.
Can you tell me what you're talking about when you talk about the John Holt movement of the 70s and 80s?
Sure. John Holt was a former school teacher that had a lot of criticisms of schooling just in general. And so kind of segueing as part of the back to nature movement that was occurring at the time, he felt like trusting children was an essential piece of what was missing within the school walls. He didn't see it happening when he was a teacher. He had difficulty making it happen for his students. And so he felt the best answer to that was just to get rid of school altogether and to allow parents to bring their children home and for those kids to get to learn in a more natural environment.
Well, we'll get back to some of the thinking along those lines, but I want to let you finish your story of how you decided to unschool specifically with your kids.
Right. So I always knew I did want to do the homeschooling. In my head as a child, I had imagined that they were doing all of the things I was doing in school, just doing them more quickly and then getting to do the other stuff. And so when I thought about homeschooling, I originally envisioned something that was kind of an accelerated program, spend 2, 3, 4 hours a day at the desk, you know, unlike the 7, 8 hours of school, and then be able to go off and explore.
So like as a kid, you felt like you could just learn the stuff you needed to learn more quickly on your own?
Yeah, school was easy for me. It was kind of a skill set that I had, the type of academic work. And so I was the one that always finished first and was waiting until folks caught up and was generally had already learned the things that were being taught. And so I felt like much of my schooling was a waste of time as a child. So I saw these big portions of the day that I could be doing something either more fun or more productive or that type of thing. And so it was when my oldest daughter was just about to turn 5, we moved to the Kansas City area, and I was looking to meet community. We didn't know anybody up here. We moved from Wichita. And I went to the Learn Homeschool Group, which is a group that my family is still a part of that was a couple years off the ground by that point. And it was there that I met families that were more familiar with the variety of ways one could homeschool and introduced me to unschooling. And originally, I had a lot of the same questions that people will ask of me, like, how do you know what they're learning? You know, what if they don't want to do X, Y, or Z? How does that all work? And it really was just a bizarre way to think about it, particularly from somebody that comes from a very schooled background. I have a degree in elementary education. My master's degree is in special ed, you know, and I had done all of these things related to school. So it took my brain some time to wrap around it. But once I started doing some reading, talking to additional families, meeting children that were unschooled, it really spoke to me in a way that the academic work just hadn't.
I've given a little bit of an idea of what unschooling is. Maybe you can provide a more like thorough definition.
So there are actually a lot of definitions floating around out there. Going back to John Holt, it really is just about letting children explore their natural inclinations, their interests, supporting them in that, offering different resources, different experiences from which they can learn and grow.
So does this mean like the kids banging on pots and pans a lot, so let's pursue music?
It may mean offering to pursue music if that's what they want, but it also means knowing when to step back and just watching them bang on pots and pans if that is what they are needing to do at that time. Not everything has to be turned into a pedantic teaching moment. Banging on pots and pans, pounding on the piano without formal training is where the creativity and the internal motivation and a lot of that stuff is rooted. And so you don't want to overlay that with instruction that somebody isn't asking for.
I guess the natural question I feel like arises as someone, like you were saying, from a schooled background is, but what if they don't ever express curiosity about a thing that they super duper need to know, like division? There's no chance. I'm pretty sure I would have never asked to learn division.
So typically those types of more specific skills show up as they get older and they start to have more goals. So, you know, there's constant conversation going on in unschooling families about life as it is now, as well as how things could potentially be in the future. And, for example, my older son has always expressed kind of more of an interest in things mechanical related, and that's kind of where his brain was functioning. And so as he got older, we started having those conversations. Well, if you want to go to college or if you want to go into a trade, then you're going to need these specific skill sets. How do you feel about starting to spend more time developing those particular skill sets? And the really interesting thing is when you have a child that's interested, and particularly if you have someone that is older, you know, kind of has a more developed set of other skills, thinking skills, that a lot of those things that we spend, you know, 6, 8, 10 years of schooling teaching them day after day after day, they can pick up in a couple of months, and then you just move on to, you know, the next thing that they're wanting to do.
What were some of you, we're going to be speaking with a researcher on childhood development and psychology in a moment, so maybe we'll get some context for some of those things you just said, but I'm curious about your biggest challenges early on.
So my biggest challenge was probably wrapping my mind around the entire thing and de-schooling myself. And that's something that's talked a lot about in the general homeschooling community, not just for unschoolers, but kind of letting go of the trappings of school, that there is a right way to do everything. You know, if you happen to pick up a workbook and you're playing around with it, if it says you need to underline the right answer and your child decides that what they want to do on that page is color it and maybe look for the B sound instead of the A sound or whatever it is, that's okay. You can just not do it. And then that trust in their ability to learn and grow and understand the world around them when it's not being broken down and given to them in a very specific format.
You know, parenting comes with a lot of uncertainty, even when you feel really strongly about an idea. Mm-hmm. You can just still have a lot of doubts about how to handle things, even as you're handling them in exactly that way. Yes. So I can only imagine that with something as big as the decision to educate your children on your own at home, going counter to everything you had experienced as a child, everything you learned, getting graduate level degrees, there must be moments of doubt along the way when you question this.
Absolutely. And like you said, with parenting, it's just all those pieces that something's going to come up regardless of whether it's, you know, how you're feeding your child or what kind of health care you're providing your child. All of those questions arise from time to time. And as unschooling families, we go through our more challenging moments like everybody else. And so, you know, when there's some headbutting going on in the household and you're thinking, oh, what did I do to, you know, make this decision for my family? Or if your child's having a hard time.
You don't step away from each other for a large portion of the day and get other input.
Right. Well, and we're very fortunate in the Kansas City area that we have an incredible homeschooling resource community between groups and outside classes and that type of thing. So very, very rarely will you find a homeschooling or an unschooling family that it's just parent and kids hanging out together 24/7. There's just too many other opportunities for that to happen. But, you know, children go through difficult stages. Parents go through difficult stages. Life goes through difficult stages. And when that happens, it's very easy to look at the thing in your life that, like you said, is different and say, I wonder if that's the thing to blame. And you just have to kind of remember, ground yourself, go back to the reading, go back to folks that you know within the community and say, no, we just all go through rough spots sometimes. And that's just the way life is, regardless of how education goes or whatever the other thing is.
You have a lot of kids. Can you talk about how this works with different personalities, different learning styles? Like, does it seem to work better for some of your kids than others?
It looks very different for some of my kids than others. And my oldest daughter, firstborn girl, was very naturally bookish, kind of took after me, firstborn daughter as well. And fortunately for me, also really gave like the in-laws, the grandparents, some reassurance that this could potentially work. She was reading early. She always had a book by her side. She was very successful when she started at community college. It came naturally for her, very much like it did for me. My next child was the polar opposite. He has some learning differences, which showed up very early and that I was aware of simply because of my background. I was like, I can kind of see what's going on there. But I kind of went back to the research and the work that's been done in unschooling and democratic schooling in some of those communities. And it said, nope, for kids like this, we can also trust the process. Let's just trust the process. And so I worked with him or just kind of lived with him, offered him the resources that he wanted when he asked for them. And
like what?
So he has a diagnosis of dyslexia, and he didn't get that until he was a teenager, even though I was well aware of it when he was very young, that was something that could be written on a piece of paper someplace. But my view as it's evolved is that these types of diagnosis are useful for receiving tools and accommodations. So if you're in school, a diagnosis of dyslexia gets you a set of accommodations that could help you be more successful in school. As homeschoolers, as unschoolers, I'm able to make those adaptations without those diagnoses. So we just kind of made changes. We did a lot of audiobooks. So he is extremely well read via audiobooks, those types of things. But as, again, we were approaching his later years as a homeschooler, I started talking to him about college. And if you went to college, these would be some expectations. This might be some accommodations. Would you like to get a formal diagnosis? And so he opted to do that. As a formal diagnosis, he could also get remediation. He opted not to do that because he felt like the strategies that he had developed for himself over, he was about 15 when we did that, I believe, over those years were working better for him than they would have. And ultimately, he opted to join the military. And in the military, you don't get accommodations. They don't even allow for you to have previous accommodations. So,
well, call 816-235-2888 if you have questions about unschooling. That's what we've been hearing about. You can raise those questions with Jessica Mattingly, who's unschooled her own kids, and with our next guest, who is an education researcher, Matthew Westra. Good morning.
Good morning, Gina.
So you are a volunteer here. We meet just about every fun drive. It's great to have you here in your own expertise. You teach psychology at Longview Community College, childhood development, adolescent psychology. You include homeschooling and unschooling research in your curriculum. Is that right?
That's correct. I offer in my adolescent psychology class that students can pick one of several books, one of which is about unschooling. And I present it as not a way to persuade them, but for them to consider, why do we have the assumptions about schooling that we have? Why do we think that it has to happen in an uncomfortable chair at a small desk in a classroom with several other kids and a teacher at the front who is in elementary supposed to be the expert about everything? And then later on, we give subjects. So just to question, why do we hold these assumptions?
You know, if our assumptions may or may not be correct about how it is best to teach, why not work within the system to sort of address that as a larger community?
Boy, so much there that we could unpackage. Part of it is the system is driven by finances and financial priorities. And for example, when I was in sixth grade, we had 42 sixth graders in that class and Mr. Madala. And the fact that we were all just accounted for at the end of the year was amazing, much less that he could get 42 kids to learn anything. And so we often hear people say, well, 16 would be an ideal size. Well, why is 16 an ideal size? Or is that just the best that we can justify paying for out of tax-supported schooling?
Well, so that does bring up that as I've been listening to all of this, you know, the stories about watching cousins who were traveling so much of the mm-hmm. year as homeschool children, et cetera, the financial accessibility of homeschooling or unschooling seems like it also would present significant challenges for a lot of the population, like that this is not, is this an option that's really available to everyone?
Yes. And of course, as with anything, I mean, what kind of dwelling do you live in? Your economics is going to make a difference. Of course, it's going to be easier if you're wealthy. But there's a lot of people that that have no wealth, that you know, live in poverty, that are able to do this. We have a lot of public resources. The public library is available to all, and it's a limitless source. And there's a lot of things that they have that are electronic. So you can obtain or go to the library and get on the computers, download things. So there's a lot of things. You just have to be more creative when you can't just swipe your credit card.
Now, I want to acknowledge this is what you have done with your own kids.
Yes.
And so we're going to talk about your experience shortly, but I want to contextualize it with your research. I mean, how does the research, like, either how does it fit within what we know about different stages of development?
Okay, first I have to caveat, I don't do research myself, okay?
You know the research, forgive me.
Yeah, that's all right. I don't want to have anything, you know, come back on you or me. But kids learn, like all of us learn, through context and through interaction. We don't learn sitting passively and supposedly absorbing. This is why there's all the criticism about straightforward lecture in even college classes, that an interactive presentation or lecture is better. But when people have to just sit and be passive absorbers, they don't absorb much. You can imagine listening to Greek radio for a year. You're not going to, after a year of that, if you don't already know some Greek, you're not going to have picked much up because it's not interactive.
I guess, though, this whole idea about you're not going to learn Greek without interacting, you're also the idea that you have to have some foundational knowledge mm-hmm. for some things later in life. That is one of the things that I think concerns people about this whole idea is that are there some things that you have to kind of learn at certain times in your life or that you really will learn more easily? Like language is mm-hmm. one of those things that I've at least heard that you learn that more easily when you're young. So what if the kid waits till they're 12 to develop the interest in learning a foreign language, whereas you could have started early and probably would in a school system?
Except in the school system, we don't. We hit high school, you're 14, and you get Spanish 1. And a friend of mine, now deceased, used to talk about going off to teach language classes at the college. He said, I'm off to teach kindergarten because we're talking about days of the week and the names of colors. And, you know, this is my hand and that is my foot. If we present it more naturally, if you are exposed to those languages in infancy, you're going to pick them up more fluently and a lot easier. And in the school environment, we don't present that stuff when the kids are very, very young either.
As both a parent who's done this and someone who knows childhood development, can you talk candidly about the pros and cons of unschooling?
Well, I can talk about pros and cons from my own experience and my own. My oldest is 29. We've been homeschooling mostly with an unschooling approach for 24 years. And the pros are far more than the cons. So some of the pros, you generally just get better kids. You know, nice, polite, they interact with people. They've not been conditioned to think that if you're not in my grade, then either you're better than me or I wouldn't want to hang out with you. They talk with adults with the same ease as with kids. Their cross-gender relationships are not sexualized. I remember myself in school, and if you have a friend of the opposite sex, oh, is that your girlfriend? Oh, are you kissing? And so the sexualization isn't there. The age restriction isn't there.
Doesn't a lot of this depend on who the parents are who are guiding this process and how they're doing it?
Well, sure. But, you know, what kind of parents are going to be drawn to unschooling in particular? You're probably going to get people, as Jessica was talking about, people who aren't as tied up in rigid expectations like, you know, well, you're 6, you should be learning this and you should have these skills mastered. It can be more fluid, more like how kids develop.
Can you give me a con?
Sure. When my kids, those who've started college, when they started college, math was a real deficit. As you said, you just couldn't imagine saying, golly, I want to learn long division. And my kids also didn't. And so we've had the conversation as they were taking their math class. Why didn't you force me? You know, well, we didn't force you. First off, have you ever tried to force yourself to do something? Because you're not doing that. And
so you
it just didn't
put
come
the responsibility
up.
In their court.
Yeah.
Well, do you have questions about all of this? We'll be taking your calls on unschooling in just a minute on KCUR's Central Standard, 816-235-2888. I would especially love to hear from people who were unschooled as kids. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we're talking about unschooling. I've described it in my own words, but Matthew Westra teaches psychology and childhood development at Longview Community College. And Matthew, I'm going to let you define it this time for people who are just tuning in.
Boy. All right. Pop quiz. Unschooling would be more of a letting the child lead their own education. And It's very much not duplicating the school environment. So taking out that sense of specific lessons and timelines. For example, in a school, we do art because it's 10 o'clock, and then we stop being interested in art at 10:30, and it's time to switch to math or social studies, whether you're done with your project or not. In the unschooling, if you're involved in doing something, and you want to keep at it, or you're just at a stopping point and you're done, then you either keep at it or you stop.
I am totally hearing all of your arguments for it. But I do have some, like, concerns when I just think about it from my own experience. For example, I have a job where I am following a clock that counts by seconds.
Yep.
And I have to adhere to that clock. I did not like taking timed tests as a child. I did not like having to switch when the bell rang. I question whether I would be able to function in my position had I not had that experience.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't have imagined as a child that I was going to host a talk show. No chance.
Right.
Well, I just wanted to chime in here. My older son is in the Air Force. He's been in the Air Force for 2 years. You cannot imagine a more structured, rule-focused environment than the U.S. military. He did that without any prior preparation other than a couple of community college classes. Before he went into it, he was unschooled his entire life, and he thrived, and he loved it, and he's been successful at it. Right. When they want to do something, those skills are there. You want to be a radio host, you're willing to deal with the seconds.
And I'd like to tag on that. There's, like with the accommodations for people with learning disabilities and such, there are things that we can give that, like, why is this test timed? Is it really important? But there's other things like driving, where you don't get to have a time and a half accommodation. You got to hit the brake pedal now. And so how much, what do we need to do? How much practice do we need to learn some of those skills?
So let's get to some of our callers and their questions. I still have more, but as I mentioned, I got to follow the clock. So let's talk to Bob in Olathe. Hi, Bob.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. This is a great conversation. I think that it's true that we have some really difficult systemic problems in public education in our country, and I believe that all kids learn differently. But you're guests have some pretty specific backgrounds that allow them to do this in a way that might not be attainable for people who aren't, schooled in education or early childhood development. I haven't heard any discussion of something like Montessori education, which is also child-directed, but mm-hmm. includes a classroom setting. And I just wanted to point out that, you know, again, everyone should do what's right for their family, mm-hmm. but some of the characterizations of the professor who teaches psychology about public education and public schools, I don't think that I'm certain they comport with his experience, but I've had great experiences in public school. My kids have been in private school in Montessori education for the entirety of their lives and now into public school. So I just think that we have to be careful in painting with too broad a brush. I think it's a great perspective, but there are also alternatives that hew more closely to traditional education.
Well, I have a couple of specific points that Bob's brought up that I want you to address separately, and I want to make sure we hit them all. So first of all, this idea that you two both have some expertise in childhood development or education and how kids learn and how that helps you. Because, for example, Jessica, you mentioned that you were able to identify that your son was likely dyslexic very early on because of your background.
I don't know that that changed anything about what I did as an unschooling parent, because what I did was follow his lead, and that's what unschooling parents do. He wasn't much of a reader, but we enjoy great literature in our house, so we checked out books from the, you know, audiobooks from the library at that time. They were on cassette tape. And so that did not require a master's degree in special education to access those resources.
I also want to ask this question about what this idea that what is best for one family is not best for another. I mean, Matthew Westra, do you have a sense that there are families, whether because of the parents' dispositions or the children's or any whole range of reasons, who you do think really like the structure of the classroom or just the separation of the classroom is important?
Absolutely. I think that you have to do what's a good fit for you. And I agree with Bob that there are many different options. And of course, he's sending his kids to private school. That's one of those economic things.
Yeah, he talked about that he had sent them to private school and now sends them to public
right.
school. But regardless,
but that's
that is
an
also
economic choice.
Thing.
And most of the people that do homeschooling and unschooling do not have an education background. I think that that's more circumstantial for the two of us than something that drives it or allows us to be successful. Most of the people that I've known doing this do not have any particular expertise in children or education. And some people, frankly, don't like spending their time with children. you know, that's part of human diversity. We don't all like the same things. Those people probably should have their kids go somewhere for a chunk of the day. And other people really like being with their kids.
My just personal reading on childhood development, I've been led to understand that there is some importance in a child sort of separating from the parent for some portion of the day, having to live with other people's rules. You know what I'm saying?
Sure.
Is that something, I mean, as a childhood development?
Yeah. One of the questions that's often asked about homeschooling and unschooling and such is about, what about socialization? And first off, they're rarely at home all day. You know, I've said we should call it car schooling. And being among other people is vital for developing. We are social creatures and we're going to live in a social environment. We can also contrast what's the social experience in the home versus what's the social experience in the classroom or in a school or in any kind of gathering where you start getting a pecking order of bullies and victims, and you get what's cool and what's not cool. And so you learn not to follow your interests.
You know, something that this raises is that right now we are dealing with a changing education landscape as districts around here, like on both sides of the state line, are seeing shifts in demographics and funding and policy. A lot of parents are talking about the impact of testing and bullying, whether teachers understand different kids' backgrounds. I wonder if that is inspiring parents to consider options they might not think about otherwise. But I also wonder if those conversations should be happening within the schools, because as people have raised, I know you say it doesn't matter what your financial background is, but it seems to me the availability of a parent to be home is financial. The availability of a whole range of options to pursue in your time teaching your kids what is available to you is going to be different based on your finances. And it does seem like investing this energy in a system, that there's some value in that.
I am definitely a strong proponent of good, strong public education. I don't think that we have what it could be. I don't think as a nation that we set that as a priority. We cut the funding for schools. We have overcrowded classrooms. We don't treat teachers like professionals. There's a lot that we could do to improve public schooling. And I think that should be done. I'm not saying shut down the schools. And I'm not saying if you want good schooling, go to private school. I think we should have world-class public education, and we don't.
I absolutely agree that in these circumstances, there's always going to be some level of privilege that we're looking at. I do want to be clear that there are a number of homeschooling families that either have two employed parents or a single parent. I have worked part-time the entire time that I've been homeschooling because we absolutely couldn't pay the bills if I hadn't also been employed. And a lot of parents do tag team shifting, work from home, just a variety of ways to make that work. I also agree with Matthew that I fully support a public school system. Unschooling doesn't just occur in homeschooling families. There are also schools that are quote unquote unschooling schools, often known as democratic schools, free schools, Sudbury Valley, Albany Free School. There's multiple ones all over the country. Unfortunately, they are often very, very expensive private schools. In my ideal world, that would be a resource as a publicly funded educational option that families could also choose.
Let me talk to a caller. We have a caller on the line who wants to weigh in here from Independence. His name is Murad. Hi, Murad.
Hey, good morning. How are you today?
Good. How about you?
Wonderful. So I'm listening to the discussion. I love the show. I am the father of 10 children, 26 years, hands-on father. Now, my children... First, I started by not teaching them in the sense of baby talk. Two, they all maintained a high GPA. So whenever they were doing good in school, I'd take them out when it wasn't a day to be out. I had twin daughters who went to do extras work, and they went back to school and told their class about their experience. On these off times, we'd go to the Nelson Atkins Museum. We would go around town, and anything that was of interest, we'd go investigate. Now, I produced,
so you took special days to do this rather than making it the model for your children's education.
Right, right. I didn't know about unschooling at the time because my children are now grown. But that has produced children who ended up having master's degrees, working on a PhD, nursing degrees, and they're all highly successful now.
Well, raising
their own families.
Murad, thank you. So it sounds like there are also ways to blend these concepts.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Well, Matthew Westra, Jessica Mattingly, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Gina Kaufman. In just a minute, feral cats roaming wild. Are they overrunning your neighborhood? Some Kansas Cityans are turning feral cats into community cats. Their stories on KCUR's Central Standard. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And before we go, we're going to talk about Kansas City neighborhoods that are apparently teeming with cats and the people who are trying to kind of get it under control, but humanely, nay, lovingly. Haley Jester Mott has been taking care of what she calls community cats in the Hyde Park neighborhood. Hi, Haley.
Good morning.
Did you ever think you'd be on the radio talking about all the cats you feed?
No, definitely not.
Tell me the story of how this all came about in your life.
Well, I am a self-described dog person, so this was definitely something that I never expected to happen. But I woke up one morning and there was a mom on my porch.
A mom cat.
A mom cat nursing her kittens, and the snow was falling on top of her, and it was very just heart-wrenching. And I thought, man, I have got to do something for this mom. I had just had twins myself, and I thought, this mom of multiples, she needs my help. What can I do?
Feeling tender toward this mother cat.
I was. So I took to social media and asked my community, you know, what do I do? Because I'm not a cat person. I don't know. And I got great advice about how to build a shelter. And I even had a friend stop by that day and brought me food. And that's how it started. They adopted me that day.
So you built a shelter. What kind of shelter did you build?
It's a Rubbermaid tote with a hole cut out at their level with a styrofoam cooler inside. Very insulated. I put a little hay at the bottom. And I change that regularly during the winter. And
so you put that in the present tense. How long ago was this?
This has been 4 years.
So you are still maintaining this cat shelter?
Correct. Three now, to be exact.
So yeah, how did the story progress from there?
Well, you know, they decided to stay. Like I said, I was adopted, and that was their new home. And they, over the years, we've got them spayed and neutered, and they've invited some friends and family to come to the kitty buffet that happens twice a day at my house. And so over the years, we've trapped, spayed, and neutered 16.
16 cats.
Cats, yep.
And they all just kind of come and go with these shelters that are outside your house.
Outside, yeah. And not all 16 have stayed. Right now, we only have about 6 or 7 that actually live either there or nearby somewhere and come and eat regularly.
How are your neighbors reacting to all of this?
Most of them have been very supportive. We've even had, like I said, some donations, even a cash donation to help with the spay and neuter costs, because we've taken that all on ourselves. And most everyone has been supportive. We've had a few, or at least a couple, that are maybe not the most supportive, but they're pet lovers, so I think they'll come around.
Well, Ramona Hayes is with us from Spay Neuter Kansas City, where she is the resource coordinator for what is called the Community Cats Program. And Ramona, I have to admit that I'm surprised there's a whole program for this. Is it a big trend?
It is. We, on average, get anywhere from 8 to 10 calls a week for assistance or advice on what to do about community cats.
So how do you define a community cat?
A community cat is a cat that doesn't have a home. It's not going to be, it's going to be fearful of people. It's not going to be your regular cat that you can just go up, pet, and expect affection back. They steer clear of people, and they live outside, and they fend for themselves, basically. We call them friendly free roamers.
So why, if they're going to be happier fending for themselves, why, what's the argument for people intervening at all?
Well, reproduction is the biggest one. I mean, if you don't do something about a female cat, she can have up to 3 litters a year, and you're looking at anywhere from 3 to 5 kittens, sometimes up to 7, and she can have 3 litters a year. So you're looking at a lot of cats over one season.
Is there an issue in some Kansas City neighborhoods with these?
Yeah, there are overpopulations in pockets of the city. Northeast Kansas City has a huge feral cat population. We're finding more and more out in Ruskin. So it's amazing.
Is there any way to know how many community cats are in Kansas City?
There's not really a way to know, but they say they've done some studies in other cities, and they think there could be anywhere from 60 to 80,000 community cats in our city.
I mean, what are there best practices, things people should and shouldn't do if they're going to pursue being a community cat caretaker like Haley has done?
Well, yeah. I mean, you definitely want to get cats spayed and neutered, or you're going to have an overpopulation, and ignoring it isn't fixing the problem. You don't want to remove those cats from that area because obviously there's some type of food source there. So if you remove those cats, more cats are just going to come back in and take that place. So
can I just, there are lots of different kinds of mammals that they don't get spayed and neutered. They roam wild. They reproduce. I mean, what's the difference between how squirrels are behaving out in nature and how cats are behaving out in nature?
Well, one thing about a female cat is she can go in and out of heat all the time. It's not like a dog who only goes into heat once or, you know, every 6 months. So a cat can go in and out of heat as long as the weather is warm. And here in Kansas City, we're having warmer and warmer winters. We used to just consider the season to be from early spring till about September or October. But last year, we did a big operation over in Kansas City, Kansas, and we found kittens in December and January that were just 6 to 7 weeks old. So our season is going longer and longer.
It's always cat season now?
It's always cat season, just kind of like Florida. They go year-round. California, they go year-round. We're kind of going year-round here, too.
From the human vantage point, why not just have tons of cats roaming a neighborhood? I mean, what does that look like in a community when that does happen?
Our caretaker can probably tell you. People don't want tons of cats, you know, they'll get in your flower beds. They've got to have a litter box somewhere, that type of thing. They, you know, as long as they're maintained, they are manageable. But if you let it get out of control, it can become unmanageable. If you can imagine, they will only roam up to 5 blocks. If you've got a 5 block area and you've got 30 cats in it, that's a lot of cats. You don't see packs of roaming dogs or packs of roaming squirrels.
You know? I have actually seen a pack of roaming dogs, but it's been a while.
Yeah.
There are ways, though, if you don't want them in your garden or your yard, there are ways to deter cats. Mm-hmm. Coffee grounds, orange peels. You sprinkle that around the areas that you don't want community cats to roam, and that'll typically keep them away.
Mm-hmm. But what was it? I mean, So Hyde Park is where you now take care of 16 cats who roam around.
Only about 6 or 7 right about now.
Oh, so but you've spayed and neutered about 16.
Correct, yeah.
And so looking at your neighborhood, have there been issues, not with the community cats, but with sort of before you started doing this?
Yes, for sure. I mean, we would see kittens regularly, Ramona was saying, all year long there would be kittens. I've even had a box of kittens delivered on my porch.
You're like the orphanage where people are
apparently the word is
off.
Out exactly. That I will take care of them. But it's definitely, the population has definitely slowed down. We just don't see as many, and Now that the population is contained in our neighborhood, that's definitely noticeable.
How do you, Ramona, how do you navigate situations where different neighbors have different feelings about how this should be handled?
We can have people call in and we try and give them good advice. I'm willing to go out and talk to people and explain the benefits of spay and neuter. They become a good community partner. They have had a rabies shot. They can't have kittens anymore. They're documented with a left ear tip so that you know they're part of a colony that's already been spay and neutered. And
a colony?
Mm-hmm. They're called colonies. Cat colonies. Yeah. So, and that's when you have the anywhere from, you know, you can have two, you can have eight. The biggest one I heard about was in a city, Houston, that had over 100 in a colony. It was in a park. So, and they completely spay and neutered and maintained that colony. Takes a lot of volunteers.
What is and isn't legal?
Well, in Kansas City, the limit of pets that you can have is four for the city of Kansas City.
Four pets per household,
and it can be any combination thereof. So it could be three dogs and one cat. It could be four cats. But if you're feeding cats outside for over 72 hours, then they're considered your pets. So if you're feeding a colony of eight, then you're definitely over your limit of what's legal.
So how does someone like Haley, you're breaking the law, it sounds like.
Well, apparently I am. I wasn't sure about that, but I still feel passionate that this is a problem and that someone needs to address it and take care. And if I have to do that and I get in trouble for that, then...
And
well,
we at Spay and Neuter were working on getting the ordinances changed so that if there was a cat that had the ear tip, it wouldn't be picked up by animal control. It would be left alone unless, of course, it was sick or injured. Then we would want to get it in and get it taken care of. But those cats would be allowed to free roam.
Is what happens if animal control does, are there people who would sort of prefer to see that be the way this situation is handled?
Yeah, we've gone to community meetings and it's, you know, there are people who are for that and people who are against it. But animal control can't do anything about cats because there are no leash laws for cats. So you can't just call animal control and expect them to come out and pick those cats up, because if they're not sick or injured, they're not going to do that.
Plus, if they pick them up, there's nowhere for them to go.
Right.
I mean, if they take them to a shelter, that's a death sentence for
right.
that cat, because they cannot be re-socialized and rehomed.
You know, I want to talk to Nancy, who's calling us from Drexel, Missouri. Nancy, what's your experience been?
Well, actually, it's about my son who lived in Eudora, Kansas. And the neighbors had outbuildings behind his duplex, and there were feral cats multiplying. And he had just moved there, so I guess he was kind of lonely, and he started feeding them. And it got into quite a bit of money, and I said, Chris, just take one cat and make a pet out of it, and don't feed the others, because they'll become dependent on you, and they won't be able to go out and, you know, keep the vermin down in the neighborhood and that sort of thing. And so, but I wasn't smart enough to tell him, take it to the vet first and make sure that it isn't diseased, because it gave him a permanently damaging problem with his eyes.
Well, Nancy, I'm so sorry to hear that. We're running out of time, but I just want Ramona from Spay Neuter KC to respond to this.
Yeah. Typically, I mean, I haven't had any experience with that type of thing, but the best thing is to get them spay and neutered.
And to keep them outdoors, probably?
Yeah, they need to stay outdoors.
And vaccinated, they'll do that, too.
Yeah.
Well, Ramona Hayes with us from Spay Neuter, Kansas City. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Haley Jester-Mott, thanks for telling your story.
Thank you.
Our time is up, but you can catch anything you've missed on Central Standard at kcur.org/Central Standard. We archive all our conversations there, and you can subscribe to have them sent to you like a podcast if tuning in every day at 10 is tough for you. kcur.org/Central Standard is where you can do that. Tomorrow is a food show. We're talking about apples and restaurants worth driving to and restaurant news. Tune in. KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Melody Rowell with Kathleen Pointer, Coy Duggar, and Suzanne Hogan. Sophia Gillespie is our intern, and our senior producer is Sylvia Maria Gross. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date's next.